Greencore.
Hello, and welcome to the Saladcast on Saturday, the 23rd of March, 2024. I'm your host, Dan Train. Joining me today, Zachary Burgess.
Do a barrel.
And Robin Kemp.
Yes.
No, I can't. He's got nothing. He's too ill to make a funny follow-up to that.
My brain is operating so frustratingly slowly.
I hope you enjoyed that clearly Star Fox inspired intro.
Oh yeah, that's why you did that. Okay.
Rob's really, really not working today.
I mean, you did all the work towards that, Rob. So maybe you deserve to not have to think about it right now.
Yeah, we were talking about it last week, weren't we, before we...
Yes, when we'd already heard it, and I referenced it at the end of the last podcast. Mm.
Just to how much the sort of casual chord progression, I suppose, of the Happy Salad theme is just Star Fox Corneria. So
it's pretty much matches Corneria.
It's pretty much the same. It's not so much of an interpretation this time as I just got to make Star Fox.
Oh, what's that? Happy coincidence.
Potentially coincidence. As we discussed at the time, where it's just like, did Star Fox secretly influence Rob's brain when he was making the original Happy Sound song? Possibly.
I mean, entirely possible. But then I wasn't really familiar with SNES Star Fox back then.
No.
Like, no, it wasn't. And I guess we didn't. PlayStation 1 era. Was when the original Happy Salad theme was sort of concocted, I suppose.
I mean, it was composed on a PlayStation 1, right?
Correct, yes, using music by Codemasters. I don't know if, like, the internet wasn't exactly as prolific back then as it would have been, so I don't know if, like, Star Fox would have had that sort of, like, meme weight behind it. Or
I feel like we were kind of late to. When did you actually play Star Fox 64, aka Lilac Wars, as we know it?
It wasn't when it came out, because I
know
it was a little way after it launched. Even then, I didn't own it for ages. I borrowed it several times, and then eventually got a copy.
I remember seeing adverts for Star Fox 64 when I was in New York in, like, 2000.
Oh, yeah, because it was all about that rumble pack, yo.
Yeah. There was big displays for Star Fox 64, and there was a big display for Daikatana, I remember.
I can't remember where I was, but I remember being somewhere and playing it around a friend's house or somewhere. Some friend who was clearly quite well off. And we were playing it like on a big screen at the time, and we were playing Star Fox like in four player mode, which isn't that game's strength, but
no.
But I remember just being a little bit like, "Oh, this is pretty cool that we can do this on a four of us can do this on the screen." That might be like one of my early experiences with a 64, you know, and just been this is pretty rad. I guess Star Fox has that going for it. But even then, that's Lilac Wars, right? That's not...
Yeah.
That's not the Corneria theme.
I think my cousin had a SNES, but, well, again, they were lucky enough to also have a Mega Drive, and I didn't have any of that stuff. So I think I played more Sonic on their TV than I did Star Fox and the Nintendo ilk.
Super Mario.
Yeah. I think one of them had F-Zero. Yeah. But yeah, Star Fox is memorable because it's, you know, it's basically an arcade game, right? So
yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
It's about as long as an arcade game as well, because it's really not very... It's not a particularly lengthy experience.
I mean, that would have been one of the first games I played with a 3D graphics that, well, most people would have thought. If you don't count arcade games, I guess. Well, I don't think I had any arcades around, so...
No, but then I guess, like, Zach and I would have... We'd already played games like Elite, I suppose, which were 3D on the...
Yeah.
You say Zach, though, but I wasn't really involved in that.
Okay, I played that on the Amiga, but I was going to say things like Stunt Race FX, right? That was 3D.
Oh, yeah.
And it was on the Atari and the Amiga, and...
Yeah, is that good old stunt racer? I mean, does that count as 3D? I don't know. I suppose.
Is that the Jeff Crammond one?
No, not Stunt Race FX. Sorry, Stunt Race FX was the...
No, it's just called Stunt Racer.
It's called Stunt Racer, yeah, that's it.
Is that the Jeff Crammond one?
Might be, yeah.
As in Jeff Crammond Grand Prix?
I don't know, I think that team went on to make Hard Driving, right? It's like Stunt Racer and Hard Driving, they're the same crew or something. I believe, I might be wrong on that, but yeah, that guy was surprisingly competent.
But is it 3D? Like,
I mean, you couldn't call it modern 3D rendering.
Well,
no,
that's not what I mean. I mean, like, I'm not sure what the tech behind that game was, but was it even like triangles? Was it calculating vertex positions somehow and then rendering that? Or was it literally just like fake bitmaps or something?
It must have been on some level doing it with vertices, right? Because it was pretty much always accurately like rendering like the banks of turns and the edges of them. And I don't know quite how you would manage that with just like a... like the alternatives at the time, I suppose, were like Sega Superscalar games, right? The arcade ones where they were just throwing bitmaps at you to kind of potentially make a surface look rough.
If it could do that, like it would be like a layered stack of bitmaps that are positioned vertically very slightly offset to make it make the road shape, but then they'd have to constantly readjust their position relative to the screen.
Yeah, I don't think they were doing that. I think they were just doing like block triangle paints, but even those were quite expensive, right, to do like a big solid color paint across a large portion of the screen. But I guess for a lot of people, it might have been their first exposure to something vaguely true 3D.
Some super effects in there. It must have cost more, right? I guess because there was chip in the cartridge, right?
I have no idea how much. I mean, games back then were so like, you think about games now being like $70, but some games back then were $70, and on the American scale, but then price ranges were so wild back then. Some would be like 70, some would be like 90, some would be like next to nothing. It was it was the Wild West for pricing. You could do what you wanted. Video games at the time made no sense.
When did it get to a point where it was a fairly standard price? Because it's diverted again from then. I'm sure it was crazy and then kind of stabilized, and now there's more variation than there was.
I mean, it's stabilized.
I want to say like around the PlayStation era, right, when things started to settle.
Stabilized when like HMV started selling video games.
Yeah, I guess.
I think I remember PC games being about £30 English pounds.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And I mean, PC games were the ones that could be a bit more wild. It was when the consoles started to standardize all their shit that their prices got more standardized.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, I do remember. I think like 35 was a regular, was a fairly standard starting point for PS1 games. And then they would drop from there, like pretty quickly into the £20 bracket, especially once Sony introduced the Platinum range, right, where like £20 was its release price if they came out on Platinum.
Oh, yeah, with the Platinum-y
silvery box.
Silvery box.
I mean, that was quite a long time into the PlayStation cycle, of course, because that was kind of the point. It was the games that people thought were good.
Kinda, yeah. But then, like, I mean, and most of the time, actually, yes, a lot of the Platinum stuff is actually pretty decent. But then I'm sure there were cases where the things hadn't been out for that long, and then they would turn up on Platinum.
I definitely got PC games on like the re-release labels, like I don't know, you know.
Oh, there were loads of them though, weren't there? On like PC,
Comic Rally and
X-Play, no, Explod, like explode, but without the E's.
Explod,
right?
Yeah.
Or was it Explosive? It might have been Explosive, not Explod.
No longer a policeman.
Yeah, because all kinds of games came out on those weird ones. I think EA had a classics label as well. So yeah, it had like a blue sky box or something. And then the actual original box art would be a tiny frame in that.
Yeah, the tiny frame.
I think probably, I guess this wasn't a case of that exactly, but I think the version of SimCity 2000 that I actually had was a re-released, but that was like specific to SimCity. It was one of the re-releases of SimCity, but not the one where they put in like the expansion pack or whatever. SimCity 2000 specific.
Mm.
I think I had like the first re-release of it when they just basically changed the packaging and not anything about the game, and then there was that later re-release when they included the expansion stuff.
Hmm.
Urban Renewal.
Was it even the original release? Was it even a Windows 95 compatible?
I think it was. No.
Yeah, I think it probably wasn't. Maybe that's why I had that one.
Yeah,
maybe that was the re-release for the Windows 95 version.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like it was all DOSy, that one. Well, DOSy.
Well, DOS.
I mean,
well, we've gone straight to games this week.
So Rob doesn't have to think about things.
Yeah, probably.
Concentrate on the topic.
Apparently, not nostalgia well. My brain can do.
Yeah.
So if it's not horribly obvious by my voice and the inevitable coughing that will come later, I've been really unwell.
Oh man,
this last week and a bit, it's been kind of sucky. Yeah, it was like a full-on flu-y ensemble. An ensemble cast of symptoms.
Oh, how awful.
That sort of, like, it never stayed the same either. It sort of evolved over the course of it. Like, it just wasn't one thing. It was always something new. So, like, I had... we did our recording last week, and it was sort of getting bad then, but manageable. And then woke up Monday and was like, oh, hell nah. And I don't normally do that. Like, normally I think it's like, okay, I'm feeling bad, but I can sit down and do a day's work at, you know, work from home and still be fine. But it's like, oh no, this was immediate, I can't do this territory.
Yeah.
I can barely move. Like, I could, yeah, moving around felt horrible, just horrible. Like the world was spinning and I got real weak, and I'm beginning to wonder if I've had COVID because right now I can't taste anything.
Oh, could well be COVID, yeah.
So, which
did you have any, did you not have any tests on hand? Or
I do not, no.
Yeah.
Those have all been burnt at this point. Not actually burnt, I mean, like, used.
Well,
for, I mean, testing purposes.
Probably eventually burnt, ideally.
Well, yeah, probably.
The system is working as planned.
So, yeah.
I've still got some in the cupboard that were free at the time, but are probably expired now. But
yeah.
I think now you have to pay for them, but I think I can expense them.
Yeah, so that's been no fun at all. I actually went back to work Tuesday for a bit of Tuesday because I started to feel a little bit on the up. My symptoms sort of shifted, so I was still not feeling particularly great moving around, but my head cold part of it seemed to be lifting a bit, so I actually sat in on some calls and did some stuff. And then Wednesday woke up again and was like, oh hell nah.
Oh, no.
And I just went right back into some different hole. And then it started shifting to my stomach being a bit problematic, and the cough becoming atrocious, and the cough then being so atrocious that it would make your body ache and then your head hurt because it's pounding the whole time.
Mm.
And then I stopped sleeping for multiple days, which didn't help either. And it was that kind of like you put your head down and your head is so filled with nothing and everything all at once. Is all over. It's like,
yeah,
so
fog.
The thing I remember and the thing I can sort of latched onto that my brain was doing, like, so while I was trying to sleep at night, I think it was trying to like represent my current state of mind as a block of code.
I'm good.
Uh-oh.
That's a good work spillover.
Yeah. So, but none of it visualized as actual, like, readable code, right? I couldn't, my head...
Because you can't dream words, obviously.
Exactly, yeah.
Even if you're not really dreaming.
My head wasn't, straight enough to be able to put together any kind of, like, useful visible image here or any structure to it or anything like that. It was just like... All I knew was, like, if I rolled over and sipped on my drink, for some reason my brain would visualize this function in the code lighting up.
Well, I mean, that makes sense. The drink code.
Yeah.
The drink function.
And the sort of pattern that my head was in, that I was becoming aware of, was the loop I desperately wanted to not have, right, was that this errant function stuck in an infinite loop. So I'd see this function every now and then, this garbled mess of something that get sewage away or something.
It was a getter function.
Yeah, I could just see it, and it was just running, and this like almost 90s TV style patchwork quilt of corrupt text in front of me just lighting up. It's so weird. But once you're sort of in that state and you're aware of it, that makes it even worse, because it's just like, yes. I want to think about something else now, but my brain is not letting me. I'm stuck in this loop of this same stupid idea.
And that happens to me way too often when I, like, wake up too early. It's like, you'd want to go back to sleep, but once my brain is on, it's like, oh, I can't escape this now.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes that's fine. If the idea you're thinking about is cool, then it's like, then sure, go for it. Like, there was one moment where I seemed to think, like, for some reason I tried to visualize just a street or something, and I remember it not being... It's like it didn't load properly. So the, like... I don't know how to even describe this. So it's like, yep, the, like, about 2 foot above ground level, everything looked kind of normal. And then above that, everything just looked like it was a bit of fabric that had been shoved on it instead. So everything was like floopy and not right. And it's like, that was just me just...
Willy World situation. Yeah.
This is very, like, topical to one of the games I played that we'll talk about later, weirdly. Huh. It's like, Rob could have been playing this game.
Maybe I did, and I just don't know. Anyway, it's not
so your subroutines got corrupted.
Yeah, it seems like
the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager.
So I did the thing that I swore I would never do, and that was take some night nurse.
Night nurse.
Basically, because I've only ever taken it once before, and last time I took it, I lost a day and a half. Just disappeared into some green juicy hole. It wasn't quite that bad this time. I did actually sleep, but I don't know if the headache I awoke with, which has been an absolute banger today, by the way, an absolute corker of a headache. You want to put ranking of headaches, this one's right up there. But I don't know if that was induced by the, you know, trying to, as a come down from the night nurse.
You try and avoid it, but it, like, builds up while you're not conscious, and then it comes back. It's like, you thought you could skip this, but no.
You're just going to get it all now. How about you? So I don't know if I'll do that again, but having some sleep was nice. It had been a while.
Yeah, sometimes you need something to knock you out.
Mm. So I've not been playing many games through that, because I've not been able to really do anything through all of this. Like, just even watching telly was a bit of a struggle. I did listen to a podcast or two whilst in bed. And then Noam did come home from work one day and came to me in bed and said, oh, you must be ill if you've left Radio 2 on all day.
Oh my god. Shocking. I can't listen to it for more than about 10 minutes. That is impressive.
That was quite funny. We did manage to watch a few things though. Like, I watched the end of a Cyberpunk Edgerunners anime. That's intense.
That seems like that would always be too intense for watching while you're ill.
Oh, no, I did that before I was ill.
Okay.
As in the video game Cyberpunk.
The video game Cyberpunk, but the anime they made for Netflix. I think I'd talked about that. I'd started it before on the podcast, but yeah, got around to actually finishing it. And yeah, it's a bit... I don't know if how to describe it, because like, it is quite well made, and it captures what that world is about pretty well. I mean, it's in the sense that, like, I don't know, anyone and everything in Night City is kind of pointless, right? It's kind of that world's whole deal is like, oh, you want to try and be something? Well, you're going to fail because cyberpunk. It's like, it's just not how this world works, and that's basically what this story is. Someone being an idiot, continuing to be an idiot, and then a lot of people die.
Great.
In flashy, gruesome ways. It's well made. I kind of got into it towards the end. It did manage to sort of be like, well, I do want to see this through, kind of thing. But it's a hard hump to get over at the start if you're not immediately vibing with it. It's like it's going to take you a little while before you might, and that's the thing, you might not. I think there's going to be a lot of people that don't get with this at all,
vibe with it. Yeah,
and I think that's just cyberpunk all over, right? That's just its problem. It's a hard tone to vibe with. Aesthetically.
That was definitely my feeling when it first came out. Although watching you play it, I don't know, has a little more subtlety than it.
Yeah.
First appeared.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of its... Yeah, I don't really know how to describe it. But the aesthetic is kind of its, like saving grace in a way, because the aesthetic is generally very good, but it's like... But then... enwrapped in too much of, well, you could do anything in this world, so everything went to hell, right? So let's show you all of the hell. And it's like, yeah, I suppose there are a lot of bad stuff that people could do. I'd rather not see all of it, thanks.
Yeah, perhaps not.
Anyway, so I finished that. I also finished Alice in Borderlands Season 2, which, that's an ending. I don't know how much I've talked about that here before, but it's a sort of Japanese manga-inspired death game show, but they did live-action adaptation of it on Netflix. And
The vein of your Squid Games or whatever.
Kinda, yeah. A bunch of people basically get transported to some alternate Tokyo, where you have to basically play these games in order to extend your visa, but the games are as deadly as not extending your visa in this world.
So the whole thing seems kind of pointless.
Kinda, yeah. Season 2 basically wraps up the adaptation of the manga, and they do a very good job of that, I think. It's plenty stupid. Like, bucket loads of stupid. There are places where people get killed and shot and maimed, and then you think they've been killed, and they absolutely 100% could not have survived that, and then they turn up a few shots later and be like, "What do you mean you're alive?" Like, it's one of those. It does that a fair amount when it's like no spoilers, whoever. Someone basically gets torn up by a machine gun at like point blank range at one point towards the end, and now she's still crawling along the floor for a bit. It's like, no, you would be so dead, like not even a little bit alive. Like, it's nuts, but it is good fun. But apparently, like, the most interesting part of the whole thing is, like, there's a season 3 coming. So even though it's sort of quite neatly wrapped up after season 2, as you might expect, because they've caught up with the manga, and the manga ended at that point. So now I'm like, well, what are you doing? What's going to come next? I'm in for it.
You're in for it. Okay.
Yeah. I think that's my TV roundup. Oh, I want to have a... I think I may have had this rant before on here as well, right? Love Productions.
Love Productions?
Love Productions. Do we know who you mean when I talk about them?
No.
They're the production company behind shows such as The Great British Bake Off and...
Okay.
The Great
That's why I don't know them.
British Pottery Throwdown or Sewing Bee and those sorts of shows. They're all the same show.
Sure. Yeah, sure. They have a format and they slightly change the format and make another show.
Indeed. But the thing that I've noticed over the years, and that I think they're getting increasingly sloppy at hiding it, is that every time they have like a finale episode, right, and they need to have they try and get, oh, the friends and family are in, we're going to have a little bit of a crowd, and then when we do the reveal, they'll be like, yay, crowd noise. It's always, always the same fake crowd noise with the same, like, predictable... like kid in the background going, way.
Like the roller coaster.
Like it is.
It might be that same sound effect. Yeah, I'm not quite sure.
I occasionally hear that, a bit like 5 George K from the Grand Theft Auto.
But they don't just play it the once during the sequence, is the thing. It's like you normally hear it 4 or 5 times during the end of the show. And you just hear really obviously hear that same kid going, way. And it's like, and you're like, why? And they do it across all of their shows where there's just the same canned crowd noise. And it's like, just mic up the crowd you've got better, guys. Like, capture better audio.
I'm sure that's difficult, though. I'm sure all their
mics
are set up precisely for like one single person talking to them. Because that's what most of those shows are.
But I don't know why that's even necessary, like to convey the moment, like it's really a bit of a clap, some whoops and jeers, and that's all you need. It's like, have a little look at the Sky Arts Landscape Artist of the Year show. They don't do that. They have some class.
Or maybe they do and you haven't noticed. Or maybe
maybe they just have a better sound engineer, I don't know. Or editing team.
I mean, just thinking, like, I mean, people think, and probably correctly, that stock imagery will just be replaced by AI-generated imagery. But surely it's even easier to generate, like, crowd noise, like, not programmatically, but with generative AI, right?
Yeah, maybe. Well, I mean, if it had enough...
Yeah, if you go through the trouble of making the initial samples, I guess.
Mm. Training.
And then once you feed them into the algorithm, it can just generate infinite versions of that.
Yeah, I guess what you need is, well, even if they have enough stems of a crowd to work with, right, they could then mix them together in a way that's unique. So it's not necessarily...
There's easily enough canned laughter available to train a model to make canned laughter. It could even get to the point where it watches the show and laughs at the jokes automatically.
I mean, that is kind of what they did with the fake crowd noise for football during COVID, right?
Right, yeah.
It was an algorithm that was basically sort of reacting, except I'm sure it was manual.
Well, didn't they nick it from FIFA?
Yeah, or, well, supposedly.
Yeah, they worked with EA.
That would make sense. I was speculating the other day that, because I think I learned this from the Charlie Brooker's old screen wipe, but basically he was saying that, like, reality TV, like Big Brother came out in about 2000, right?
Yeah.
And the reason that they didn't, there was a sudden explosion in them, it was because, like, technology wise, it wasn't really possible to edit an entire day's worth of footage into something you could broadcast every single day,
right,
until 2000, that they reached a tipping point in terms of their edit suites and they did. But yeah. I wonder if that could happen again. Like, someone was talking about AI doing editing together a scene, you know, from some clips and doing a really bad job of a dramatic scene. And it's like, yeah, that will get better. But for reality TV, surely the editing doesn't have to be that good. It's pretty formulaic. You probably get a robot to put together your VT package for.
Perhaps these two people are speaking. Just clip that. Show some camera angles of awkward camera angles of these two people talking from.
Yeah.
And there you go. That's all you need.
Whatever cameras you have.
Clip that up.
Sticking some B-roll while the voiceover is talking or whatever.
I mean,
if there's anyone in the background making a weird face, cut to a camera that looks at them for a second.
They already have a system a little bit like that for Wimbledon, right? That's kind of. They've had it for years where the AI systems are watching the match, and at the end of every point, they present the producers with a bunch of replays and cool slow-mo shots that were taken during that last passage of play. Yeah. So the AI is not actually choosing what gets shown still, but it's presenting a whole bunch of options.
Options, yeah. I'm sure that stuff will accelerate.
It's pretty cool. I mean, some of that's pretty cool. I do like that. Yeah, that side makes total sense to me.
Oh, right? It is cool. Yeah.
But I don't know. Is Big Brother really back? I know it's on like ITV now.
I have no idea. Is it ITV? It's relegated all the way to Channel 5 at one point.
It was at one point, yeah. Then I think 4 picked it up for a brief. I mean, 4 had it originally, right? Then it went to 5. And then I want to say 4 got it back, or someone else ran with it for a bit.
Did they get Davina McCall back?
For like, what, an anniversary season or something? Yeah. And yeah, now it's on ITV1 as a. Trying to make a
because
thing
the BBC stole Gladiators, obviously.
Well, yeah. I need to pull up the lyrics for the Gladiators theme tune, right? Because it really bothers me, like every time I hear it, just how awful like the verse is at the end of it, or the like bridge, I guess. Hold on, bear with.
Seriously, are you watching Gladiators then, Zach?
No, I don't watch any actual TV, even on iPlayer.
No. Me either. I'm definitely missing out on some stuff.
Yeah.
But there is no like shared culture anymore because.
No.
Sorry, that's actually me laughing, not coughing. Right, so the lyric question that really bothers me is is the main sort of verse. It's like, do you have the courage of a hero? I'm fine, whatever. Do you have the will and the skill? It's like, okay, that's slightly crappy rhyming, but all right.
The will and the skill.
Do you have the speed, the strength, the heart to be a winner? It's not for beginners. Deep down in your soul. And I'm like, where did that deep down in your soul come from?
It's not even, deep down in your soul.
It's not even referring to anything around it. Like...
It's like those two other lines have just like got stuck in the middle of the sentence where if you took them out and then shoved deep down in your soul at the end of the list of other attributes, it's like that would work. But like it's like they've put a giant parenthesis in the middle where it's like we'd have these two other random things happen.
Well, yeah, because it sort of makes sense like in the questioning part, right? Like it's like do you have the speed deep down in your soul? You know, like if you were to say that sort of thing. But it's like there's this little aside in between it. It's like the heart to be a winner. It's like parentheses. It's not for beginners. deep down in your soul.
Who's got speed in their soul apart from Sonic the Hedgehog?
Obviously, and the Flash, probably. Presumably.
Yeah, I guess.
I kind of enjoyed the new Gladiators at first, but it's wearing a bit thin.
As Gladiators does, I suppose.
It probably always would have.
It's like watching Wipeout. Like you watch a few, but then it's just like, I need a break from this because it's all exactly the same.
Yeah. I did end up watching that reboot of Takeshi's Castle on Amazon. It was alright.
You're never going to recapture that kind of thing.
No, the magic's not there. It's not quite the same.
It's not analog enough.
Yeah, there's not enough volleyballs to the face.
It's not enough hardcore safety violations.
100%. Everyone's too much
panic. Hit your face directly on the plywood.
Well, that's the TV minute. What's going on in video game news? That's what I want to know.
Not much.
No.
Possibly even less. Let's take away into that first story, I guess.
Well, I guess the biggie is the PS5 Pro leak. Ooh. So there is going to be a PS5 Pro after all.
Well, obviously.
I mean, how do we feel about that in general? Because I'm in the camp where it's like, I don't feel like I need a Pro version of the consoles this time round.
I mean, you've been patiently waiting on the PS5, so that's quite good for you to get.
Like, you haven't felt like you've needed a PS5 yet.
It seems weird because they just haven't been, because the games.
I mean, the games are good.
AAA games take so much to develop that obviously there aren't that many to warrant like a whole new generation, well, sub generation. But it does mean if you haven't got a PS5 right now and you want to play Grand Theft Auto 6 in the best possible way.
Well, yeah, even though Digital Foundry suggests... Well, okay, so it's worth talking about what we know about the PS5 Pro, I suppose, and whether that makes you feel the same way. So it's supposedly targeting holiday this year for a release. It will likely have the same CPU system that the current PS5 has. Aside from the possibility of a small 10% boost that it can use every now and then. It's sort of like a short bursty thing, I guess, to when the thermals are good, I guess, it could do a boost for a little bit more juice.
Mm.
I mean, I think PC CPUs have had that kind of stuff for ages. The big change is in the GPU power, which goes up probably about 3 times. If you're talking about in terms of raw teraflops, from 10.28 to 33.5 teraflops, which is no small number. That's no small change.
I mean, if your average game has and seems to have a quality mode and a performance mode, right? That seems to be the standard. So if they make a console that gives you the quality mode graphics at performance mode frame rate, and that's pretty good, right?
Yeah, but assuming that the enhancements aren't CPU bound, that's the big thing, right? Like, so are you necessarily going to achieve full-on ray tracing with all that more raw GPU power? I mean, the jury's a little bit out on that one, right? Because it's, you might need more CPU power to actually help build that secondary version of the world that the rays need to be cast upon. So it's hard to know. This is basically the same sort of step they took with the Pro and the One X in the previous generation, though, right? It was pure GPU power over anything else. And it did make a difference. I'm not saying it's not going to make a difference. It did make a difference. But whether it's the kind of difference we, I guess, gamers would want to in these days, is like, I'm not sure that that's there. Or we'll just have to see. Anyway, DF seemed a little bit skeptical on the benefit being quite as pronounced this time round.
Is it physically smaller?
I don't think there's been any, like, size leaks or anything like that, just the specs.
Just a leak, right? That says,
are they going to re-release Last of Us again specifically for it?
Oh, you bet.
They've already re-released it so many times.
Well, now it'll be in 8K, because apparently this one has spectral super resolution. Whatever that
spectral
means.
So like, it won't actually be in 8K, is what you're saying. It'll be some faked version of 8K. Yeah,
it'll be upscaling. Some kind of upscaling. So it's a little unclear whether this is referring, like, maybe Sony have their own version of DLSS or FSR or something like that, even though I think the PlayStation already supports FSR, which is AMD's tech, because it's an AMD GPU, right? So that's a little strange. There's no explanation about what that is, or pricing. Most importantly, because PlayStation have shown no interest on lowering prices on PS5 to the point where the new slim model is more expensive if you want one with a drive. So yeah, how do we feel? Like, I don't know. I don't feel using my Series X that I've ever sort of thought, I could use a few more teraflops. I haven't really just had that as a feel like it was a problem.
No, I know.
I've not been dissatisfied.
Maybe it is future-proofing for something like Grand Theft Auto, I don't know. But that will have to run on everything, so...
You say run on everything, I bet that... Well, I mean, they'll only talk... They'll run on Yeah, Series S is always the challenge, right? I mean, that gives them a bottleneck.
I think they might negotiate a way out of that Series S situation, if anyone can. I'm sure it's Rockstar. Or
maybe.
But even then, like, do you think this is enough juice? No, probably not for Grand Theft Auto 6 to run at 60.
I think it's like some of the simulation stuff is where the difficulty lies, right? How much of that can run pure GPU as opposed to CPU bound?
Yeah, exactly.
Just how much is GTA 6 doing with its crowds and its how much Florida is it simulating?
Because you can run Red Dead 2 at 60 on a PC fine without screwing up the logic and everything.
You can technically run it on a Series X at 60 because it FPS boosts it. From the what do you call it? The one version. I don't know. It just feels a little unnecessary this time, I guess. But also, does this mean we're halfway through the generation, guys?
I think so.
Happy halfway point. What's move, Nintendo?
Well, they better fucking move at this point.
I know.
We've talked about it so many times. We're just like, when is this goddamn company going to tell us anything?
Well, yeah, because I watched a Princess Peach Showtime review just to see what that game actually is.
Yeah,
it's meh, as far as I'm concerned. But even that was just like in spots where it's just like, yeah, it's got weird performance blips, and it's like, oh, really? But even for what that game is, it's like,
yeah. The weirdest was when that Link's Awakening on the Unreal Engine had performance glitches sometimes.
I don't know if that's weird. The fact that it was quite, like, I guess a less experienced person trying to run the Unreal Engine.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Still ran better than Pokemon.
Well, that's a whole different situation. Pokemon's problems are not necessarily related to how good or bad the engine they're trying to use is.
That's that. Dragon's Dogma 2 is not only good, it's probably great, aside from your usual dosage of PC performance problems and surprise microtransactions.
What game doesn't launch with performance problems on the PC? I don't.
Aren't many, are there?
Be worth games that are also on consoles.
Right, yeah. It'd be worth checking in whether that Forbidden West PC release runs well. Because they're making like it's got a whole bunch of improvements for PC, like completely unlocked frame rates so you can run it as fast as you want, super widescreen support. You know, they've apparently done the work on that.
Right. Because that engine has proved itself on PC, right, with
Death Stranding. Yeah, same engine. I think Death Stranding
like
came out
good scaling, first, scalable tech.
And then they put Horizon on it on PC. Yeah. So it should be all right. Anyway, the thing about Dragon's Dogma 2 is just that's the Steam reviews are currently mixed because of the people's surprise. It's like, why on earth does this game have microtransactions? And the reason is, why not? Because it doesn't need them. You don't need to buy them as a player, but they give that confusing vibe of, am I missing out by not having these? Because some of them look like featurey type stuff, but they are apparently mostly things or entirely things you could earn in the game anyway, so you don't need them. But it just creates a negative vibe, which is a shame because apparently that game's pretty rad. So, way to like screw your launch, I guess, slightly. Screw your sentiment. And also maybe not buy it on PC. for slight performance issues. But that's that. I guess as long as it's not bad as, what is it, the Jedi games, right? That's still a train wreck on PC, I think.
Right, yeah. Which I don't understand, because surely Respawn can make a PC game. Anyway.
You'd think. Titanfall 2 was, you know, perfect. But that wasn't Unreal Engine.
Yeah,
though.
That was Source Engine, right, I guess?
Was their own, long-term derived version of Source, yeah.
I mean, but Gold Source is Quake, so, I mean, who knows where it comes from?
Alpha Protocol. It has been relisted. I didn't even realise it had been delisted, but it's been relisted. Thanks to the good folks at GOG.
Is that Obsidian?
That is Obsidian, yes.
Yeah.
That was one of their basically most praised like conversation systems in any games, right? Because it has such a wide amount of options and like the ways you can get out of scenarios and the way characters will then interact with you later in the game, or which characters will die, or like the range of possibilities is immense. Even if the actual game part of the game is a bit jank, it has its merits, and I'm sure I've never played it, but there's a bit of me that does sort of go, oh, this sounds... There's enough about this game that sounds wild enough that if you made some real stupid choices, some real stupid stuff could happen. I might be down for seeing that. Maybe there's a video series in that somewhere. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, but we didn't play at the time, right? But,
no.
I don't know. That would be a curious one. I'd be interested to give it a go.
Yeah.
A bit more interesting than just going back to Mass Effect, which is a bit obvious.
Sure.
Still might be fun, but yeah.
You want to make have a game where you can make super dumb choices and then have some kind of super dumb, fun outcome.
Yeah.
Just embrace it. Embrace the dumb. Come do what my brain is doing right now. Amy Hennig, you know, that person that never makes a game.
Oh, right, okay.
Ooh, sick burn. she's only really famous for Uncharted, right? But has been on failed project after failed project after cancelled project ever since. But her new game, a Marvel game called 1943 Rise of Hydra was revealed. This is the Captain America versus Black Panther thing that we've sort of heard about in the past, and there's a couple minute story trailer out. It's being developed by Skydance. I think it looks pretty good. Okay, no gameplay is like in that trailer. I should point that out, but it's like they're sort of going for that sort of like dark Nazi vibe, I suppose. It's like if you imagine the first Captain America film was entirely shot at night, then there you go. You might have what you're thinking about.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I thought the visual tech looks pretty nice. It's all apparently being done in Unreal 5. They're using the MetaHuman animation systems.
Right. Is that stuff finally coming through? Nowadays, it's interesting how maybe the generations will no longer be defined by hardware and just by like the version of the software coming through.
But yeah, some of it looks real, real good. In that kind of like, I mean, video games have always looked uncanny, right? They've never really fully got out of the valley. But it's but they're starting to get to that point where it's like, what's his face? You know, like when the Star Wars films, like they suddenly introduce like a CG character or someone who's dead, and they bring them back. And they're normally pretty good, right? But they're not quite right.
Yeah, I don't know. The advantage they had with doing Tarkin in
That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah,
in Rogue One is obviously they cast that actor originally because he's creepy looking already, so that helps. And also he's a creepy villain, but still doesn't work for me. Like, and then right at the end of the film, they've got one shot of Carrie Fisher resurrected, which is not even. I think she wasn't actually dead at the time. Obviously, she is now, but that didn't work for me at all.
Hmm.
Docking, okay.
Yeah.
Bit distracting, but fine.
But yeah, do you know what I mean? It's like they're not bad, but you still know, right? You still know.
For sure.
You can be impressed by it, but you still know. And I kind of got that vibe a little bit from some of the facial animation here. It was like, it looked like a notable step up, but also you still know. And maybe there's something about like the way like studios like Naughty Dog and stuff like that. Maybe there's something about how they do their facial animations or something. So it's like, it's uncanny enough that you disconnect.
I mean, this is a very long time ago now. And of course they never repeated it because apparently the setup for it was so ludicrous, but I still found LA Noir
quite,
you know, those performances were like, you could connect with those performances, even though obviously
they have a whole bunch more subtlety than even a lot of modern stuff, right? But it's but the graphics tech, I suppose, at the time was a little bit crude, and it kind of did all sort of blur together a little bit at times.
But like,
right?
The actual capture process was apparently insane.
Yeah,
I think,
I'm sure,
to make it work. I don't think. But then, like, you know, modern techniques are different. You know, obviously, like, I love, like, I don't know, Uncharted 4, or I guess Last of Us Part 2 level cutscenes or whatever. Motion capture is good enough, you know, but it doesn't feel real or anything.
Hellblade. Because, like, Hellblade
that's the one
is
that's coming.
Yeah, Hellblade and Hellblade 2, they are using all this crazy hyper facial.
Full blown, yeah.
Yeah. And I think OD might be as well, the Hideo Kojima joint.
I guess the Death Stranding stuff, maybe.
Yeah, Death Stranding as well. There's definitely ways to make it look good, but it's. Yeah, anyway, go check it out. See, maybe you'll get that same vibe. See what I mean?
Sweet.
And finally, the Sims movie is in production.
Oh, is that a good idea?
I don't know, but it's got the production team from Barbie working on it. And also that Margot Robbie, you know, Barbie from Barbie.
That sort of makes more sense than all the other... Because obviously Barbie was a huge success, and all the idiotic Hollywood executives were like, let's find another toy to make loads of money out of. And it's like, you completely missed the point of that film if you think you can turn the handle and like make another one with another 80s toy or something, whatever. That is not the point of Barbie. But The Sims potentially has potential in that kind of satirical kind of angle that Barbie had. It just isn't nearly as well known as Barbie, let's say.
Well,
even if it's a well-known computer game, it's not like Mario, you know.
But like, The Sims is just another concept along the lines of like Free Guy or Ready Player One or whatever. Like, well, maybe not Ready Player One, Free Guy certainly, but like, it's just a like computer person that becomes aware that they're in a computer, basically.
Yeah, like Truman Show type.
Yeah.
I mean, it could work. That could work, potentially. But
what, and she slowly learns English?
Yeah, right, because all the dialogue will be Simlish with subtitles, right? Clearly, in this film.
Yeah. Only if they do it well.
Oh, dear.
But they wouldn't be like subtitles, would they? They'd be like picture bubbles. Because that's how The Sims did it,
well,
right?
No, but for the film purposes, it would be subtitles.
Maybe.
Unless they go full Minions and just have it not even any language.
I think that's likely that it will all be English. They want to make money.
Yes, it will probably be like they'll throw in The Sims right at the start and then just do some kind of like fade into actual English.
Exactly.
There's like some video.
In the Hunt for Red October.
There's like some video art movement or something where people make like short films or something, but all of the dialogue is not English, right? Like, it's like none of it actually is a word, but they're doing scenes in such a way that it's like, oh, you still feel it, right? But none of it's actual, or you still vaguely feel like you understood what was happening, even though none of it was actually real words. I think they had it on QI once. It's weird.
That's quite clever, potentially, you know. I'm sure you could explore some stuff there without having any actual semantic meaning to the dialogue, and it just be
Oh, and one of them gets out into the real world somehow and then has to use their green diamond to save the planet.
I mean, there's got to be jokes about being trapped in swimming pools and all that.
Someone watching you while you pee. It's that game, right?
Yeah, I guess. Well, it'll be the joke where, like, they get undressed, but, like, the sensor bar is just, like, part of them. Like, it just appears as soon as they try to take their clothes off.
Yeah, right. They go to a doctor or something, and it's just like, oh, no, I can't be seen. Well, that's the news.
I guess it's time for what you've been playing, and I heard Zach's been playing a few things.
Yep, 3 whole new games in the space of not even 2 weeks. It was mostly just this week, which might tell you about how long these games were. And they were, you know, at least one of them was on topic from Rob's illness and dreams.
Oh, yeah. Okay, let's draw it back to night nurse hallucinations.
Well, actually, I guess kind of 2 of them were, weirdly. Let's go through these in the order of, like, the one that I like least to the one that I like most, I suppose.
All right.
So the first one was Superliminal.
All right, yeah.
Which is a puzzle game. I guess it's a puzzle game. And obviously, as the name implies, some amount of liminal spaces going on. You're basically lucid dreaming is the whole concept. So you're going through all these weird environments where it's just like, this looks like a hotel, but, you know, everything's weird. But the actual puzzle mechanic of it is to do with, like, depth perception, essentially. Like, you pick up an object and it floats in the middle of the screen, as video games do. But then, like, when you're looking around, the context of what that object looks like in your field of view becomes real. So when, like, when you let go of it, if you're looking at a faraway wall, the object then becomes huge because it was far away.
Yeah, I've seen this in action. It's kind of cool.
It's kind of cool, but it's like, that is kind of the only mechanic of that game. Like, it doesn't really, there's a couple of instances of, like, the old like lining things up, and then you're looking at a painting and then you line up the object in and it just becomes real in the world or whatever. That kind of thing. But they don't even use that often. It's mostly only the resizing objects by picking them up thing. And that's kind of most of the mechanics of that game. Right. And you don't even have that much of the mechanical puzzles, really. There's a lot of just walking. You know, doing a bit of an experience, I suppose, of this weird dream state world.
The dream hotel experience.
Yeah, and a few other environments. It did. The funny thing was, it's like, the liminal space idea. It's like, obviously, you've got the weird, creepy hotel corridors thing, and there's some, like, parking lots and that kind of stuff, and it's like I was just waiting for it to eventually go to, like, swimming pool changing rooms, and it did eventually get there, but it took quite a long time. I was like, when are we going to get to tiles? Tiles are going to come up at some point, and then they did, and I was like, yep, there you go. But yeah, that was quite a. The puzzles are not complicated. So, well, I mean, I got stuck at least, like one of them, but then you get, because with that kind of mechanic, you get into the situation where it's like, did I even solve that correctly? Because it's like, you could, obviously when you're resizing objects, a lot of the puzzles are just about, like, climbing up stuff, right? Like, there's a ledge you need to climb up, so resize the box so it's big enough so you can actually jump on it and then climb up there. Like, that's the simplest version of that. But then when you allow the player to just, like, resize objects until they can climb on top of them, then you're getting into, like, how much of this have I just cheesed by propping an object up at a specific angle so I could walk up it? And
how much Tears of the Kingdom have I been playing?
Well, I mean, I wish it had that much control, because it's actually kind of annoying to get things to rotate the right direction, because you only have horizontal rotation. Like, there's no other degrees of freedom to that. And for some reason, the rotation is inexplicably, like, super slow as well. I mean, that might just be how it's... because I was using mouse and keyboard, and I think maybe it was hoping for controller. But yeah, I mean, that's... that game. Also, I mean, like, you play for it for the experience, I guess, and, like, the little bit of puzzling, but then it has... it has achievements for a bunch of collectibles, and I thought I was getting most of them, but then when you get to the end, it's like, I haven't got basically any of the achievements.
Oh.
And I'm totally not going to go back and try and grind those out.
No.
The thing is, I hadn't even looked at the achievements at all, but, like, two of the collectibles that I was getting, I didn't even know that, you know, that they were. I was just doing it because it was a thing to do. Like, basically, you can click on fire extinguishers to make them, you know, put out a cloud of smoke. And you can also pull fire alarms, but it doesn't do anything. So I was just doing that, just because I was like, oh, there's another fire extinguisher, there's another fire alarm. And it's like, oh, those are actually two of the collectibles.
Oh. And, like, collectibles that are just for achievement hunting are, like, probably the most annoying thing you could add to, like, an experience game, I think.
Yeah. Right. It's like, especially when, like, when the puzzles are that straightforward, it's no fun to go back and do them again.
Yeah, if they have absolutely no purpose at all, like why throw them in? It's like, at least even, the, like, Gears of War, who we can blame for probably adding this to video games, you know, with the dog tags, right? Yeah. It's like, at least those had a little bit of backstory associated with them when you found them. But even so, that's still, you know, looking back now, I think, yeah, what a waste of time. It is to just be in the middle of this, like, dramatic moment or something, just be going, no, I'm going to inch by inch my way around this environment until I can find this friggin' dog tag.
I mean, that's the other problem of collectibles, is, like, how difficult do you want them to be to get? Because, like, the skulls in Halo are so ridiculous that, yeah, like, that's sort of cool to do. It's like, it's gone far enough that they're so inconvenient that you're not going to get them naturally, and therefore it does make it sort of a challenge to do them.
Yeah, I wish Halo did a better job of, like, showing you where they were.
Yeah, so, just giving you some kind of hints.
Yeah, so then the getting to them could be the challenge, right?
Yeah,
I think Halo could have done a better job of that, rather than, because they were so well hidden sometimes, like, tucked up in tiny little corners of places. Just absurd. Just absurd. Yeah. I mean, have those too, sure, but make them like Easter eggs rather than the skulls that did things.
Well, sure, that wasn't the actual problem with the Halo skulls. It's like, they actually unlock stuff,
yeah,
which I guess you could argue is the old classic, like, unlocking cheats
thing. I suppose, yeah.
They are meant to be, like, special when you get them. But yeah, that was super liminal, because there's not much more to say about that. It was pretty straightforward.
So you finished it. It gets a meh.
Well, it gets a, like, it's fine. Play it on Game Pass. Play it on Game Pass.
Oh, it's on Game Pass. I didn't know it was on Game Pass. Okay.
Yep.
It gets a thumb tilting up, is what you're saying.
A thumb with some number of degrees in the vertical.
Super liminal.
Oh, which that just reminds me that one of these games, I think it's one of the later games, but had, like, in its... Oh, no, yeah, it was one of the other ones, but had the super hot team help them. It was in the credits. It was like, oh yeah.
Oh, okay.
But we'll get to that in a minute, because that was the one that I liked most. The one that I liked second most, well, actually, I might call these two almost a tie, because they're both actually good. But Jusant.
Oh, right. The second one. The climbing game.
That is also on Game Pass, in case you want to get to that.
Yeah.
Say again, what's it called?
Jusant. It's French.
Jusant.
It's very French, in fact, because it literally says that when you start the game. It's like, this means, it's a French nautical term, means the receding tide, which is kind of what the game is about, kind of, but not really.
How's
it's about climbing,
then,
obviously.
For our listeners?
It's Jusant.
Jusant. Okay.
But yes, it's a game about climbing, where you climb up this big old pillar tower thing.
Like, gut Czech rock or whatever it is.
Yes, kind of. It's actually, so, you know, it's like it is a sort of a cylindrical tower, inexplicably. Where it's like, how is this thing not eroded or fallen over at this point? But it's very big, and you have to climb it for possibly story reasons, I guess. I don't actually, like, I do kind of want to talk about the story, but I don't want to talk about the main story. So, like, no spoilers for the, like, main story, but there's this secondary sort of story that you, it's like the background of the world, which I found really cool, but then doesn't go anywhere.
Oh.
Because the main story is, like, the main story. That's the bit that actually goes somewhere. But, like, this cool scene setting of the world is, like, that doesn't actually go anywhere, and I was sort of disappointed. Because, so you start in the lower areas of the tower, and there's a lot of just, like, nautical shit around all over the place. And, like, you can see where there was docks and where, like, boats are hanging off the edge by their mooring ropes or whatever, because the ocean has mysteriously disappeared as you start to gather. And so you're at the lower levels, you're getting there's like text logs or whatever you find around the place that sort of give you the story of various things going on. But in the lower levels, they're talking about how, like, no one really knows what the ocean or rain is any longer, and they're having to go out into the desert of the ocean floor to find springs to be able to survive. And then as you start going further up, it's like as you go up the tower, you're sort of going into the past. So you're starting to get more information from people who understood things that have been long gone, because as the oceans went down, people moved further down the tower. So even as you start climbing up more, you're still seeing like docks and stuff, except they're even higher up than the ones you just were at.
Hmm.
So as you go further up, you're starting to see people who do know what rain is and what water is. Basically, and then you're coming to like, so you come.
How are these people surviving if they don't know what water is?
Well, that's not really gone into very much, but the water, it seems like the water ran out relatively recently because there was like a reserve of it. Like the ocean went away, but then they still had some amount of water because you eventually get off into like a reservoir, basically. And it doesn't seem like the population that was living on this tower was super high, essentially. Right. But as you go further up, you get to like an archaeological site that's like a big sundial, but the text logs don't understand what a sundial is for because the sun doesn't move anymore.
Oh.
And then like there's other references to that where like someone is talking about how their job is called seasonal, but seasons don't exist.
Huh.
And every time anyone refers to like day or night, they refer to it as cycles and sleeps.
And I'm like, how do they have night if the sun doesn't move?
Well, that's the thing, because like as you go even further than that, probably one of the last text logs you get right near the top is like where people know the most. It basically
spoilers
implies,
I suppose, at this point.
Well, it's spoilers for this secondary story, which, as I said, doesn't actually like go anywhere. But like, it implies that what is actually happening is like the planet has become tidally locked, so all the oceans evaporated from the sun side. Because like that last log references that like the sun facing side is getting hotter, which you could infer like applies to the tower, but I think it's actually referencing the sun side of the planet.
Right.
And then up in this higher reach of the tower, there's like a constant gale force wind blowing across it from like the atmosphere being blown across the surface by the heat.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, that's a really cool concept, but like, as I said, that doesn't go anywhere.
backstory.
This is just the cool backstory for this post-apocalypse, basically. But yeah. I thought that was really cool. It was
Neat.
A cool idea.
Neat, yeah.
But not really relevant to the actual story of the game.
Wow, excuse for the setup.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's an excuse for the apocalypse.
But yeah, did the apocalypse need to be excused?
Apart from that, the climbing is like the obviously the main mechanic, and it is pretty cool. Like how you obviously it's trying to be fancy about it, so you've got like your left hand right hand grip on the triggers, and then you can spool out the rope and swing and stuff, and like it does sort of, it's another situation of like I would have liked it more if it had like 10% more mechanics, but it's fine as an experience game.
Right, yeah.
because like you have a stamina meter, but it's almost irrelevant. Because also the game doesn't really explain the stamina meter very well, but like you have a stamina meter that goes down as you're like moving your grip essentially. But at any point, you can just press left trigger to rest, and then the stamina meter goes back up.
Mm.
So it like that makes you kind of think it's pointless. But the secondary mechanic to it is that like when you do a jump, that reduces the maximum of the stamina meter.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like you essentially have less time between rests, which again still isn't actually relevant since you can rest at any time. So even if your stamina bar is really tiny, you can just like move a couple of times and then just rest, and then move a couple of times and then just rest. So it's like that mechanic is sort of not super important in the end. And the same for the like you can place an extra attachment point on the wall, which is useful for the swinging mechanic. But in the early game, it's like, oh, it will save you if you fall off, because then you'll be attached at this later. It's sort of like a checkpoint system, only you choose when to implement it. But none of the climbs are really that awkward or, you know, long enough that matters, really. You're not going to have very many cases where it feels like it feels dangerous enough that you need to do that, except for much later in the game.
Sure.
And then also, annoyingly, that can like actually screw you in some cases, because you have a limited length of rope. And so there's one case it did screw me is like you're climbing around this sort of U-shaped bit of wall, so you're starting on one tip of the U and then climbing around the wall to get to the other side. But if you attach your rope to the wall along the way, that uses up too much of the length of your rope, so you can't actually reach the next thing you need to get to. So you need to like deliberately not attach to the rope to the wall as you go around.
Right. Which so is like, you can't just like say, oh, I'll just pull my rope in.
Well, not in that way. Like if you've made one of those attachment points, you actually have to physically go back to it to unattach it.
Oh, interesting.
But what the easier part of that is like once you're standing on flat ground again, you can just push a button to reel in everything you've set up. So once you've climbed to the next ledge, you just press a button and the rope goes away.
Okay.
That's not a problem that you have to deal with. But yeah, those are pretty cool climbing mechanics, but yes, it's definitely going for slightly more of an experience again, not necessarily super hardcore on the climbing mechanics.
Right, yeah.
Supposedly there was an early prototype version of that game where they had you do not just your hands but also your feet, so you were using like all four shoulder, like both triggers and the shoulder buttons on a controller to control all four at once.
Oh right.
But obviously that was a bit too complicated.
I find it interesting that this game comes out of Don't Nod.
Well,
you know the Life is Strange team.
Sure. I mean, it's not like you're not talking to anyone. That's but, for sure.
Yeah, it's a bit of a departure for their more recent style of games. Like, because they haven't really broken away from Life is Strange or Life is Strange style games since that got big, right? Like, they did some sort of, was it a character action game before? It was Remember Me, I think it was called. Where it's a bit of a combat focused thing with some detective vision stuff. And so, yeah, that was like the last quote unquote gamey game, I suppose you could say they make. And then they come back to it with this, which is, I don't know, well, I think that's quite nice.
I
forget which one I played. I can't even remember what it was called, but it was the one with the psychic twins that came out on Game Pass like a couple of years ago. And I found it so. It was bad. Long story short, it was bad.
And it's that specific kind of game that they made for a while was definitely a thing that, like, you either liked it or you didn't.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know if that. I'd only played Life is Strange, the first part of Life is Strange. I didn't even finish, like, by that, I don't mean I finished Life is Strange 1. I mean, episode Pop, 1 yeah. of Life is Strange 1. And, It seemed like it could have been interesting, you know, the time rewind mechanic that kind of made its thing. But even then, they moved away from that, right, from the subsequent projects. So it wasn't even about that either. and they just simplified. So they became less and less interesting to me. I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of nice to see them going in a game direction.
Yes, at least partially. Still kind of an experience, but slightly more gameplay. Mm. So yes, that's another far in a positive direction played on Game Pass.
Okay.
Situation. Probably in a more positive direction than Superliminal was.
Angled a little bit higher.
Yes. And then the last one, which I think is probably... I mean, Superliminal was maybe slightly like Rob's dream states going on, obviously.
Yeah.
But the much more specific one, for a reason that I won't get into immediately, I guess I'll talk about the game a bit before we get to it, but like Viewfinder was the last one.
Oh, sweet.
Which is a game about photographs. Who cares?
It's Superliminal, but for photographs.
Well, yeah, that was the thing that, like, because I played Superliminal, like, pretty close to playing Viewfinder, it actually kind of was slightly confusing to me, because in Superliminal, the whole point is you hold an object up and then, like, the depth perception determines its size. Hmm. But in Viewfinder, you're holding a photo up and then the photo becomes the world. But that doesn't affect its size. Like, things retain their size in the photograph, so right. Going from one of those to the other kind of confused me for a while, because I was like, why can't I make that bigger? Oh wait, that's not how this game works.
Oh right, so like if you bring it closer to your face or like,
well, you don't, because like, you know, you're holding it at a set distance away, like in Superliminal, except that distance doesn't affect it. It's like you're looking through the photograph as the photograph exists, like the depth perception of the photograph is the same. So if something's small, it's far away rather than just being small.
Gotcha. So the scene in the photo is what determines where it ends up in the world, right? Yeah.
So yes, that's the trick of that game. And it's I don't know how like complicated this tech is nowadays, but it is very cool.
Hmm.
How difficult it is to program this, because it does just like it just cuts through the geometry like of anything.
Right.
Like, you just place the photo down and it just overwrites that whole chunk of scenery and just cuts straight through everything that's on the edge of the frame.
Hmm.
And that includes like even movable objects get cut like that. Like if you mess up and place a photo that cuts through a battery or something, you just get half a battery that's no longer usable.
Huh.
So yeah, it seems kind of technically impressive, but I don't know how difficult that is nowadays, because, you know,
it's the who knows what. It's the tech from Metal Gear Solid Revengeance.
Yeah, pretty much.
Cut the everything slice up. Tech. Yeah, slice tech.
But yeah, that is the puzzle of that game, and then it starts off with... It actually, I guess, weirdly, for like, I guess if you've ever seen previews of this, like everyone who I've seen videos of playing this is confused that you don't get the camera immediately. Like, you don't even get the camera until like halfway through the game, actually. Up to that point, you're just finding photographs and putting them and then using those.
Yeah.
Which does kind of make it like, you know, the puzzle progression can be a bit easier there because it's more restricted.
Sure. I that was my understanding of it anyway, that I didn't think the camera was an immediate tool.
Well, it's kind of like the name of the game.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but yeah. I don't know. I don't even know where I would have got that idea from. But yeah, that was my understanding.
Probably like, yeah, I guess maybe you saw a different preview video that
maybe.
Like showed it a bit more realistically. But yes, you go around and use these, and so I guess like. Not exactly spoilers, really, but like I guess it's kind of messing up. Kind of a cool effect is that, like, obviously you're not just using photographs.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, in one of the very early levels, they show it off more extremely by like you walk up to an easel, which is typically where up to this point you've been finding photographs. They just sit on, in these early levels, they're trying to make it obvious where it's just like this easel just has a photograph attached in the middle of it, and obviously you're going to want that. But then in this level, you walk up and instead of a photograph on the easel, it's just a sketch. So you just put that up and then you walk into that and like, you know, it's just a shader or whatever over the geometry, but like it looks like pencil lines.
That's cool.
But then they then they continue to do that for the rest of that level, where like inside the sketch part of the level you then find a picture that's like, I forget what the second one is. I think the second one is a painting, so it has like a, like everything is soft edged like a painting when you walk into it, and then it's like a cartoon, so everything has like cell shading. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a child's drawing, so it's got like a paper aesthetic to all the stuff that's not like these crayon lines. And then you go into like a pixelated image of a castle, so everything has like a pixelated filter over it, except it is a filter. It's not quite like you'd want to do that the hardcore way, where everything actually is like pixel edged. It is just a filter over the view of it.
Not like the Ratchet and Clank pixelator gun.
No. But yes, that is where like that game gets a bit more fancy with it not just being pictures. And sometimes not even things that are like literally pictures. Like you can pick up a playing card and just place that for no apparent reason.
Oh. Huh.
I mean, it still cuts through the world, which you could use, I guess, to carve out a chunk.
Make holes.
Yes, make holes.
Make holes to put things in.
Sometimes. Sometimes you need to put yourself in a hole.
Indeed.
Cut a hole through a thing so you can get through it. And then, yes, once you get the camera, you can start doing the more fancy stuff of, like, well, like copying things, essentially. Just take a photo of something. No, I mean, obviously the first time you do it, once you get the camera immediately, you're like, well, I have this one battery, but I need two. But then I'll just take a photo of it, and then now I have two.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And that idea continues. And it obviously runs into the portal situation of like forgetting how things work. Well, even though you're introduced to that immediately, there were still several times later on where it's like, how do I get another battery? Oh, right, yeah, I can just take a fucking photo.
I can just copy it as many times as I want. I can then take a picture of those two batteries and then have four batteries.
Yep.
And then...
So that leads to one of the slightly annoying things similar to Superliminal of the achievements, where it's just like... I'm not sure why it does this, but it has a bunch of hidden achievements, which makes sense because they're trying to hide, you know, spoilers, basically. But like, that's really annoying for if you want to get the achievements, especially because in this case, the achievements can be like very level specific. Like one of the hidden achievements is for making like 32 batteries by copying the batteries and then just taking another photo of the copies or whatever.
Right.
Make the most number of batteries you can. But that achievement is only on the first level where you get the camera.
Oh, right, I see.
And it's a hidden achievement, so unless you showed the hidden achievement to know that, there's no particular reason why you think to do it on that level over any of the other ones where you have batteries.
Yeah, why hide that? That's a bit weird.
Well, it's because they don't want to spoil that mechanic in the achievements.
Yeah, I guess.
So yeah, there's several other ones along those lines.
Then have an in-game system so it's not hidden there or something. So once you get that ability, you can see that achievement.
Well, yeah. I mean, that would be the ideal situation would be it would just unhide those achievement descriptions once you reach a certain point in the game. But that's not a system that... It's supported in achievement systems.
Well, it'd be done in the game itself, right? You'd write your own window to it.
That would be how you do it.
You'd just have it hidden in Steam or on Xbox or whatever. You'd just then have your own internal view.
But yes, it gets gradually more complicated. It gets more weird. The sort of later levels get into mechanics of like things you can't take photos of course. Because how are you going to restrict this? Mysteriously, some things don't go into the photos.
Hmm.
And then the very last mechanic, which is where it gets, you know, the most crazy about it, is like taking photos of yourself.
What?
Selfies.
The thing is, it's not selfies. It's like, because the cameras you use for this are like fixed. So it's like timers. You trigger the camera and then run in front of it before it goes off. But so what that mechanic does is when you take a photo of yourself, when you deploy that photo into the world, you just teleport to wherever you are in that picture. So you can basically like pass through walls and stuff by just positioning yourself in the depth perception of where the photo is, or over a hole.
Oh man.
Oh, weird. So you can't just, you know, take a photo.
No, you don't clone yourself.
No, I was wondering how weird that would be. Like, or if you, I mean, if you imagine if you did take a selfie of yourself, how horrific would that be? Like, you just put that in the world, and it's like, oh, yeah, there's my severed head.
Yeah, luckily it doesn't worry about that, even though it should. If you get most of yourself in the picture, it just works. It doesn't worry about how you've just cut yourself off.
Oh, you've just teleported into a version of yourself without legs.
So yeah, that game is a very cool bit of tech. And the super hot thing, and also the Rob's Dream thing, which I'll get to in a sec, the super hot thing in the credits, I don't know if this is actually a thing that actually came out or not, but supposedly the super hot team was helping them with a VR version.
Oh, right.
Which would be pretty nuts, probably.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure, I don't think it would be as cool in VR. Because, like, you'd be able to tell when it changed from a flat image to a full 3D model in VR, right? Because you actually have depth of perception.
That's the thing about a viewfinder, literally, is it's 2D, right?
Yeah, I see what you mean.
So I don't know if that was just like a prototype or whether that actually happened, because I haven't looked up to see. And then, so getting finally to the weird Rob's Dream segment is like, when you get the camera, there's a machine that you can use to change the filter on the photos, which obviously changes what it looks like when you put the photo down.
Nice.
Trippy mode.
And some of those are fine, which are like, oh, it's negative or it's black and white or whatever. And some of them are completely unusable, like the ASCII filter, where it's just like, I can't tell what anything is in this picture any longer, and when I deploy it to the world, that's not even helpful either, because I can barely see the edges of anything, because it's just like some text icons floating around.
That's pretty funny.
But the one that I thought of immediately when Rob was talking about his coding dream is like, there is just a field that you get eventually that's just called code, and it just puts a texture that's just got code on it over everything. Which is more usable than some of the ASCII ones, because it is just like, you know, it's just a screenshot of someone's coding interface just pasted over the geometry of the objects. But that was immediately what I was thinking of when Rob's talking about he's looking at the code of his world. It's like,
surely you want a matrix filter where everyone's got green text falling down the side.
Well, there is a night vision filter which does make everything green whenever you paste the photo down.
That's cool.
But yeah, those filters are sometimes usable and sometimes very not usable. But that's a nice little trick that it does as well. Of like, well, I mean, obviously it's related to the drawing or whatever. I think you can get the sketchy filter as a filter as well for the photos. So you can just reuse that style.
You want to be in an aha music video?
Yeah, pretty much. The whole time. Even with the like normal world and sketch world type thing going on.
Well, exactly.
So yeah, that's viewfinder.
Thumbs up.
Yes, that one actually is a legitimate thumbs up.
All the way.
But it's not on Game Pass.
Oh. Did you buy it on Steam?
Yes.
All the way tilted.
Thunderful.
Yes, that is the other developer, I guess. Sad Owl Studios. SOS.
Sad Owl.
Hey, who's the developer of Antichamber? Did they ever do anything else?
I don't think so, because that was like a real indie game, right?
Yeah.
It was like one dude.
Rad as flip.
Yes, I mean, that was, you know, that is a very similar game to Superliminal, basically, where you have like a mechanic, but it's all these weird environments, essentially, even though it's not. Obviously, Antichamber has kind of one environment, but it's just different parts of that environment.
Mm.
It's not like you're going through hotels and bathrooms or whatever.
bathroom of physics.
Now, that was the one thing that I found slightly disappointing about Viewfinder, actually, is that like they didn't use the physics very much.
Oh, why, like, when you drop a picture and the stuff in the picture?
Yeah, because it's like you can rotate the pictures to put them on like upside down or whatever, which is mainly used for like if there's a thing that you need to stand on but it's on the ceiling, well now you can just take a photo and then rotate it and put that on the floor instead. But like they don't really account for physics except for like very occasionally. Like the first time you get them, when it's tutorializing like rotating the pictures, you get a picture with a battery in it that you need, but that picture is like slanted or whatever, so if you just immediately place it down the battery just slides off.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And like there's some chairs in the background and stuff and they all slide as well. But like in almost every other case apart from that time and battery specifically, because they're a physics object that you need to use, basically nothing else ever has physics, even other chairs and tables and stuff. Like if you take a photo of like a chair or a table in any other situation, those are just like fixed objects, so it doesn't use the physics for them at all.
That seems a bit inconsistent. Like, yeah. Why go to the effort of make that little sequence if you're not going to make that a rule of the world? That's a bit strange.
Yes,
that's
a bit.
I don't know. That's a bit of a weird thing for a puzzle game to do, right? To like.
Well, yeah.
Or have an inconsistent rule, effectively.
Obviously, it is just trying to be like slightly more pointing it out for that one situation where they're tutorializing. I guess they're also tutorializing that the batteries can be affected by physics. But they wanted to make sure you're perceiving that by adding these extra things in the background that also move.
Mm.
But then I think there's like two other objects in the entire game that are like physical objects that you can pick up and move around, and that are therefore affected by physics.
Mm.
And it also doesn't apply, you know, there's a lot of other things that you would expect to have physics if you rotated the photo, like, you know, hanging flower baskets or whatever.
Right, yeah.
They just stay exactly where they are, regardless of which angle you put the photo at.
Hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, because I'd played that old game Snapshot, and that game was much more about the physics of storing a physics object inside the photo and then redeploying it. Like, I was kind of expecting that to be a thing in Viewfinder, but they don't use that mechanic. It's much more about the physical geometry that's stored in the picture rather than the physics of what's stored in the picture. Mm. So yeah, that's the super level of Tucson. It's like, that's the 10% more mechanics I would have liked.
Right, yeah. God gives Zach that little bit more, developers.
Well, I mean,
haven't you learnt this by now? You need to give Zach that little bit more for him to be like truly satisfied.
It's all these video games that just don't quite go far enough in the mechanics. Which we normally complain about with like remakes more than new games, I suppose.
Yes, yeah.
If you're going to remake SimCity, you've got to make it better. Not just City Skylines 2.
No.
But you can see where they need to get to. Just to push it a tiny bit further. Surely the people making these games must know, like what you know.
Yeah, I mean, you think so, yeah.
But maybe they think, oh, that's too far, or they can't quite make
it. Well, I mean, I think I said this about when we were talking about Suicide Island 2, when I did play that for a minute, where it's just like, as much as I would like, you know, like lane assigning the roads and whatnot, casual people aren't going to like that, but too much.
Yeah, I guess. But that is a class of game where you can cater beyond the casual, for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, theoretically that is the same situation for puzzle games, that like as you go further into the game the puzzle should get more complicated, and that would be the opportunity to do more fancy things like physics or whatever. But do you then want to have this like situation where a bunch of people play like half your game?
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because like puzzle games, no, even not that long ago, right, where they would have basically a central concept, right, and they would just keep using that same set of mechanics and just get harder and harder and harder. I would imagine the majority of players, there is like a drop off point, right? Like how many? What is the? I wonder what the percentage rate for those sorts of games are. It's like, do people get to about 50% and finish, and then never carry on because it's just stuff that's too hard.
Yeah.
Because I would probably put myself in that category for plenty of games, like where I just got to a point where it's just like, no, I can't. I just haven't been able to figure this one out and never finished it. But then they weren't, like, or they also weren't narratively driven, like, or they didn't have a narrative element to it, so not finishing right. It is not the end of the world. It's just,
yeah,
it's just like, I found my peak.
Like out of those three games that I talked about, like Viewfinder definitely has the least story, so okay. It's fine that you know people might drop off of the puzzles, but like obviously Jusan, that's pretty simple and it has a story.
Yeah,
and then
you want people to finish
Superliminal. It's just like. But no, I mean, the Superliminal story doesn't matter, really. Not like, I mean, Jusant is actually trying to tell a story.
Right.
Whereas Superliminal, it's just, it has a story, I guess, but not really an important story. But you can get through it to get that whole thing. And Viewfinder has a story, but it's much, much less important if you're only interested in the cool mechanics of the puzzles. You don't need to worry about the story at all.
There we go.
Yep, that was my week of getting through some Game Pass and stuff that I bought at like Christmas.
Thank you for injecting this podcast with some much needed fresh content.
Yep, I might continue that. I actually, speaking of new games that I've been playing, it's like I actually, for the first time ever, used the stupid Steam feature of being able to categorize games, because I was let me actually make a category in my Steam list for games that I should get round to playing.
Oh, yeah. Not just games I own that I might play, just the actual backlog that I'm going to tackle.
Well, yeah, kind of.
Move from the backlog to the to-do list, yeah.
I mean, it's just because it puts them at the top of the list, so it's like, I'll actually just visually see them. And it will remind, because the Viewfinder, I almost forgot that I'd already bought that at Christmas.
Right.
And it's like, oh yeah, I already did that. I should actually get around to playing that. Because that's way down the list, obviously, with a V.
Yeah. You got work to get to that point. Especially if the Steam UI, like, hitches a little bit as you first scroll down.
Because it's loading all the icons, yeah. As it does.
What a pain.
So yes, I'm not going to spoil, but there are four more games that I've put in that theoretically things I should get around to playing list. I don't know if I'm going to get around to playing them anytime soon or ever, but you know, they're there.
I consider myself forewarned.
Games are coming. So, Rob, you've mostly been too ill to be playing any games.
Yeah, I haven't done a lot in the last couple of, in the last week, but the week before I was plumbing away at a bit more Yakuza 0 and a bit more Forager, really. Don't have a huge amount to say on either, really. Forager is, I really need, I feel like I need to just get through that thing now. Like, I'm out of the honeymoon period now. It's just like, right, I need to get stuff done. I need to figure out what I need to do in order to just get this done quicker. I'm not done with it yet, but I want to be done with it, if you see what I mean. I want to get done.
I mean, at least that game specifically does have a full in-game achievement list that tracks progress, so
yeah.
You can't just go look at that and be like, what do I need to do?
Yeah, so I should have discovered the books a lot earlier. Basically, that seems to have been my mistake, because that would have unlocked faster XP.
More XP.
Yep, I really, really could have done with that. A lot sooner. So I'm working on those, and it's just like, yeah, the bits that I do now have and things I can do just seem to take forever in terms of like actual manufacturing at this point.
Well, I mean, that's the thing of like... You also need to kind of remember that you can scale up somewhat. Like, you can just build like 5 furnaces to do Royal Steel and just set them on infinite, and then just that makes it happen 5 times as fast.
Sure. But I'm still reluctant to do like stuff of that grade at like infinite.
Well,
level,
sure, yeah.
There's a bit of me that's just like, I don't know if I'm ever going to need to just burn all of my supply on this material. Maybe there's some other material, because it like isn't like, especially, it's especially annoying with the royals, right? Because the royal materials, there's the cloth and the steel, and they both pull from the same
gems, yeah
the same stash of gems, of which they like Are they supposed to be of differing rarities? Because I always seem to be lacking in one.
No, I don't think they're meant to be. I think like they even out eventually.
Right. Yeah. I'm just a statistical anomaly in my gem collection.
Yeah.
I want to see what happens when I complete a what's it called? One of the museum collections, which I'm very close to doing. But I still
not
can't.
Super interesting. I can tell you that much.
Oh, damn it!
I think it's probably just a box with another spirit orb in.
Right.
But you know, spirit orbs are always useful. Get another heart to trade in for potentially another drone.
Just get more banks and get more land. Seems to be all I need to do.
Yes, I think one of the biggest like hitches in like the mental progress in that game is like the money, because it's like you don't know what is safe to sell and like is it worth selling, how much money does that actually make, how many banks should you make, because that's an investment in materials obviously, because you're having to make the stuff to make the banks and they get increasingly more expensive. And then like once you sort of get over the hump of having enough cash to do things, I feel like that scaling ramps up super fast at a certain point. Like you'll struggle for money for a long time, and then you'll hit this just point where you're just like, oh, now I just have way too much.
Yeah, I've got quite a bit of money. Like, so that's not so much of a problem. Like, if I buy a bit of land, then they go deal with its thing, and then do a bit of manufacturing for a bit, and it's like, oh right, now I've replenished my loss. It's like I'm not so bad. I can see that number is ramping up a bit in the future to come.
Yes.
So I may have trouble
and then obviously, but there's the dumb like super late game achievements of like make a million coins via just banks.
Right. Yeah, so I don't know quite. I don't know how much longer it's going to take at this point, but probably quite a bit. So anyway, I've taken to like turning off the game soundtrack and having some Spotify play on the background or something.
Yeah, sure.
So like until I find something new and interesting, that'll be how I'll plod away at that. The problem is like I was kind of, a bit of me thought it's like, oh, this is mindless enough for when I'm ill, but it's not really, because it's like it's bright and brash and
everything jiggles.
And everything jiggles. Yeah, and I know I could have turned some of that off, but it's like, yeah, it really wasn't great for your eyes, or if you're feeling that little bit woozy,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
The whole game is constantly doing a bit of a wobble. Well, the sea level is constantly moving around.
Yeah, and it's constantly like slightly zooming in and out along with all the wobbling.
Yeah, it was not the best figure to actually try. So anyway, yeah, still doing a little bit of that. And I'm at the point in Yakuza 0 where I'm in finale. So I've got to that chapter.
But then like does it go like finale epilogue again?
Oh, no, there'll definitely be a little
last time.
There'll probably be a little epilogue, but those are normally like tiny. They're not normally a huge thing in Yakuza games, but I'm at the point where it's like I'm trying to get through like some of Kiryu's side stuff that I know I've got left, but it's kind of the annoying stuff now. So it's like, if I want to get through I'm trying to get through the real estate game, which is how you get like most of the money. So it's kind of worth doing, but it's quite tedious now just being like, I'm going to start collecting payouts from all these places. I'm going to then go off and do something else. And I'm starting to run out of things to do something else about in Kemerocho. Then come back and I'll collect that money, and then I'll reinvest that money, and then I'll say collect, and then I'll leave the office and go do something again. That cycle's getting a bit tedious. So one of the things I've been and you know, as I say, the things I could be trying to do are also kind of annoying, like stay alive.
doing your best.
Go score a turkey in the 10-pin bowling game. But the bowling, like, I don't know, it's one of the more inconsistent bowling experiences you can have in video games. It's like, it's not that easy to score. strikes consistently. So, so when the lady behind the desk is sad every time you come away from a game going, oh, you didn't get a turkey, and you're like, mm. And Kyria is also like, oh. Everyone's sad. No one's happy. It's not like Majima's going to turn up and randomly play a game with me. And I've still got all of Majima's side still to do, so I haven't really done all of his, or all of the Cabaret Club's R stuff. There's a whole bunch of that I haven't touched on the other side of the game. But I haven't had the opportunity to do his stuff for a while. That just hasn't been, because of the way the story is, I just haven't been able to do it. I'm in a sort of weird place where I am probably going to have to just bite the bullet and finish the game, but then I know what will happen, and then it's like a little bit just like, I'm probably not actually going to go and do the things I kind of wanted to sit out and finish, because it's just how it goes with these things. Maybe I prefer the Yakuza games where there's just one protagonist, right, and I can just do that and just be like, I can do whatever I want at any time.
Less restrictions.
Yeah, it makes sense, like narratively, why it's in this situation. But like, yeah, it's a bit frustrating for the way my completionist brain works. Not that I'm saying I'll ever be a completionist on Yakuza games. That list is far too large. And there are just some things in it that just aren't good. Like, I've done as much as I think I can of the pocket circuit racing. I've got as many parts as I know that I can buy. I've found a few secret parts around the world, but I don't have a complete collection of parts for my car yet. And so I take it into the experts race, and I can't find the magic combination that will mean my car beats the other cars. I just haven't been able to figure it out. Even though I've finished, I think, all of the little side stories that are around Pocket Stadium, like the actual just win this race, I've not been able to do. I don't know if I can be asked to sink more time into trying to figure that out. What else am I up to? I think there's a darts thing I'm supposed to go do, maybe. Don't know. Basically, I went and played darts with a guy, and he was plying me with drinks every round, and then, of course, you get drunk as the game goes on.
And I'm not quite harder to play darts.
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure if I'm supposed to bail out early, or just beat him once and then run away, or if I'm supposed to like just keep drinking and there's a challenge for like beating him over a certain number of games whilst heavily pissed. I don't know.
Realistic darts experience.
Yeah. There's definitely one thing I do want to do, and so I discovered how to unlock Super Hang On. You befriend someone at the Sega high tech land.
They have a secret arcade.
No, they don't. You and her just get into having like high score battles on Outrun, and after a while she becomes. Your friendship bar builds enough that she convinces the manager to get hold of a Super Hang-On machine. Obviously, this being a Yakuza game, they word it quite differently. She says, "I'll give you the ride of your life," and of course, jokes ensue. Lol. But then you unlock Super Hang-On as a game you can play. Yay! I think I'd like.
Yay!
I mean, I appreciate their efforts to bring like old Sega stuff into the Yakuza game. It's really cool to see, but I think I think there's a weird omission like in the games in this time where I feel like they don't have analog control. Like, because Outrun you played with a wheel, right? It's not just like snap left, snap right. Hang On, you lent on a bike, a big ass bike,
physical bike.
Yeah, and so to get the route, you just don't. I don't feel like that's being represented on the controller inputs. I think you're either like slammed left or slammed right, and it's like, so I'm not sure these are actually particularly great implementations of those games, which is a shame because they're still quite fun, just in short doses. But yeah, now that I know to do that, I think there's a character in Sotenbori that knows Majima where I can do the same thing. I can befriend them, and they'll probably convince their manager to swap one of the Space Harrier machines for a Phantasy Star machine. And that'll be where I can go that. not Phantasy Star, Phantasy Zone, sorry. Yeah, so I might go do. I'll probably go do those things because they're easy enough to do. But there's
assuming like, you can get back to Majima.
Assuming I can get back to Majima, yeah. And there's Majima's whole Colosseum, which I'm probably not going to engage with because it's probably my least favorite of the Colosseums in the games I've come across so far. And also, they're the same in every single game. You know, the Colosseum doesn't really ever change. It's just in a different location now that's less flashy and less interesting. So why would that's clearly worse rather than better. And I guess I do get to play as Majima rather than Kiryu, but anyways, that's where I think I'm at with that game. It's like I've enjoyed the hell out of it, but I think my time with it may be coming to an end, so we'll see how much I can be bothered with the mop up.
Okay, fair enough.
But the story's real good. I'm enjoying the story a lot.
Yeah, I mean,
people get shot. People die from getting shot. A lot of people don't die from getting shot.
That's right.
Right.
A lot of people don't die from getting shot and then immediately get into high intensity fist fights. It's real stupid. It's really stupid. All you need is a quick overnight and a bandage and you'll be fine.
You'll be 100% fine.
And then characters do die. And it's like, oh, that is actually a surprise. Because nobody seems to want to die in this world. Well, I suppose nobody wants to die, but you know what I mean. Like,
no.
Yeah, it's a fun time. It's a fun time. And that's been me.
Well, I hope you recover fully and can continue your adventures in Hawaii and beyond.
I'll get to Hawaii eventually.
Eventually.
I got a question for you guys. I was thinking about what I think might be a plot hole in the film Star Wars, quite a famous film, you might have seen it.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering is it just me? Or is this like a common thing that fans complain about and I've just missed it somehow? I mean, it's because it's an adventure film, right? And they needed to get to the next location to, you know, finish the film and get the plot going or whatever. But like, you know, when the Millennium Falcon escapes the Death Star and they get attacked by those TIE fighters and they fight off the TIE fighters and they're like, yeah, woohoo or whatever. And Princess Leia's like, obviously they let us go. Like they're tracking the ship. Like, you guys are morons, right? If Princess Leia knows they're being tracked, why do they fly straight to Yavin 4, where the main rebel base is? After
they do
she just
sort of explain that, right?
Do they? What's the explanation?
Like, she sort of says that, like, it doesn't really matter anyway because they have the data, right?
They've got the plans, right?
They're only going to have one shot at this anyway, so like it doesn't even matter if they follow them.
So why can't they fly somewhere safe and broadcast the data to the? Do they have to go
because
straight?
Because apparently they like want to keep that data physical because that's kind of been the whole problem with this whole film, right? They're chasing this data disk around, essentially.
But why? You'd think you'd want to, like, have copies of the Death Star plans everywhere,
I mean,
so that there's
that's
some...
definitely the bigger plot hole of, like, even that goes all the way back into Rogue One, where it's like, you have to transmit this data from the planet up to a ship that's in orbit of this planet for some reason, instead of transmitting it, you know, somewhere further away, where you can be safer.
But isn't there a giant shield around that planet?
There is, but they have to open it up to transmit, though, right?
Yeah. So maybe that's why you can only get it to orbit. You can't, like, transmit through the tiny little aperture to, like, another planet.
I guess.
Maybe that makes sense.
I guess you wouldn't get line of sight the way you wanted it to go. Ooh, coughing.
Yeah, I guess. But it still barely makes sense even then.
But I just thought, like, she's just been tortured and she still didn't give up the location. And then when she knows she's being tracked, she's like, let's fly straight there.
But she didn't have the plans before that point.
No, that is true. I just feel
she
like
still thought they might be able to get away with it. She thought like Obi-Wan probably would get the plans to the rebels, yeah,
to the rebels,
but not worry about her.
Because like obviously it's necessary for to make the film work that they do that. So fine, and it who cares? But still, like, it doesn't seem sensible to just fly straight there. I mean.
I guess the theory was it's like that the Empire is not going to care if we manage to pull this off. Then they're not going to. Would they? Wait. So are they, I guess the plan would have had to have been they would disband the base once they'll destroy the Death Star, because then surely the Empire would just come straight for Rabbit.
I mean, they did, then, right? That's why they end up on.
Well, that's the idea. Is they don't know where the base is, right? And that's why they're.
Well, I mean, and also the other reason to do that after you have the Death Star plans is it brings the Death Star to you, so you can launch all your ships from the planet directly to the Death Star. No hyperspace necessary,
right?
And unless Leia was wrong, unless they weren't tracking the ship,
they were
for some reason.
But they were obviously, because that's why the Death Star immediately appeared at the Rebel base, right?
Yes.
Well, they didn't have much time, did they? They managed to analyse the plans and sort it out and just in time for the Death Star to catch up with the Millennium Falcon. I guess Millennium Falcon's quite a lot faster than the Death Star through hyperspace, but...
it's quite a lot.
How long did they have? Like a day or something? Do you think?
Yeah, I guess it's not... I mean, you don't know how far they had to hyperspace, right? How far away was Yavin from Alderaan?
No.
Okay, I guess I forget they bring the Star...
Alderaan, yeah.
Okay, I forget in the first film the Star can move.
Sure can. That's kind of the whole point.
Yeah.
Well, it's not much use for blowing up planets if it can only hang around by one planet.
No, I know, but like I forget that it's like finished. Right?
Right.
Right. Well, not the Death Star 2. Finished, yeah, that's the only like I don't know. The Emperor calls the Death Star 2 fully operational, but it's only for fully operational in the sense that it can
shoot.
Not that it can move around.
I mean, obviously, the other weird part of that is, like, why does it have to orbit around the planet? Why could you not hyperspace onto that side of the planet where the base is? I mean, obviously, it makes sense that it would want to orbit a planet because it is, like, a whole fucking moon. You know, the gravity would fuck everything up regardless of that, but, you know.
That is true. And I also get the sense that, but at that point, they weren't in that much of a hurry. Like, it's fine. We'll just go into orbit and it's only going to be an hour before we're in range anyway, so that's fine.
Yeah,
and they think they're invincible, so.
You feel calmed by Zach's explanation?
Not really. I just feel like they put unnecessary time pressure on themselves to figure out the plans by leading the super weapon directly to...
I mean, it was convenient, I suppose.
The main base.
You don't have to waste fuel getting there. Just...
Yeah.
That's true.
We've got even
more. I would.
That's not a bad argument, the fact that you actually want the Death Star where all your fighters are to attack it. But then the Rebel fighters, in contrast to the Imperial fighters, actually do have.
Yeah, they all have hyperspace drives.
Yeah, as evidenced in the third film, where they actually jump to attack the second Death Star.
I was thinking of a Star Wars plot hole as well this week, incidentally. Anyway, it's a much more generalised one, which is just like, if repulsor lifts exist, and if Luke can have a speeder on his shitty-ass desert planet that he just owns, why do AT-STs have legs?
Oh, right. Yeah.
So why does anything have legs or wheels if repulsor lifts are cheap enough that a random vapor farm in the middle of the desert can afford one?
I guess it's the weight, right, of what's carried by an AT-ST. No, AT-AT is.
Yeah, or is it more the height they want to achieve, right? Like, can the repulsor lift actually just push as high up as they wanted their vantage point?
But, like, the whole thing about the spaceships use repulsor lifts to launch into space, right? Because they don't. That's actually how they get into orbit.
Huh.
Right, but the Millennium Falcon kind of uses its main engine most.
Well, or it looks like it does.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to tell.
Because, like, the snow speeders can't get into space, can they? And they just use repulsor lift.
Right? And they can fly quite high, so if you're talking about the height limits repulsor lifts.
That's true. Yeah.
That's my point.
I mean, the main question is, and the answer is because it's cool, is like they just don't bother with wheels, do they? Even though they're quite a convenient invention.
Yeah.
If you're not going to have repulsor lifts, why would you then have legs instead of wheels?
Yeah.
Even your group of ragtag mods can have hover scooters, then wheels aren't for you, son.
In a way, BB-8 is kind of going against Star Wars convention by being something that rolls. Right?
Yeah, by being a giant wheel and not a droid.
By being a sphere, even. Not even just like, it's not even limited to rolling in one specific direction. Total freedom of movement.
Droidicas, boys.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they started to break it a bit more in the prequels, but there aren't many wheels in the original films.
Yep. The like sand crawler thing go on.
Yeah, it's got tracks.
It's tracks. Yeah, but there's
nothing. Yeah, that's quite conventional, isn't it?
It depends. Yeah, yeah, those tracks are, probably need wheels in them, right? To drive them.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they do. Yeah.
What's on the feet of R2-D2?
Wheels.
Yeah, tracks. The wheels.
Well, right, actually, yeah. I think it might also be tracks. I think in like the real diagram, like diagrammatical blueprints of RTD2, it's tracks, but in the model you see in the film, it's wheels.
It's wheels, yeah.
Or those little cleaning droids or whatever that are scuttling about.
Mouse droids.
The mouse droids have wheels. They have
presumably
wheels.
Presumably.
Yeah.
I mean, they look like they have wheels because that one does like a 3-point turn, basically.
Yeah. So good. Anyway, regardless of that plot hole, like my other question is why don't I see people complaining about that?
Right. I bet you probably could see people complaining about that if you looked on the internet for long.
You just haven't found the right hole.
Anyway.
Also, maybe you don't see people complaining about it because, like, we've already diagnosed every plot hole in the original Star Wars trilogy, right, like 20 years ago.
Yeah, okay. It's been done to death. Is that the case, though? Did people used to complain about that and now it's just been done
to death? I'm sure.
Oh, okay, fine. Maybe that's it. It's not an original thought at all, I'm sure.
Hand shot first.
All right, I thought I'd end this podcast with some Star Wars plot holes.
Podcast classic.
It's a podcast classic.
It's a new lap record.
Record.
Do an aerial on the roll.
Who says that?
No one. That's because it's not a barrel. That's what I was making the joke.
Yeah.
It's a Star Fox plot hole.
Oh, barrel roll.
Could you do a barrel roll in Star Fox? I reckon.
No, it's very specific like angle.
Because you can't go up. Yeah.
Wait, what?
The barrel roll is more like a corkscrew. Like it's
it's like you're rolling. It's literally like you're rolling around a big imaginary cylinder, like a barrel, right in front of you.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a plane can do that, but like.
But if you spin
for an aerolon roll,
if you spin around on the axis, that's just an aerolon roll.
Do an aerolon roll.
I think a barrel roll would be much less G force crazy than.
Well, and also a barrel roll would actually let you avoid projectiles rather than just mysteriously deflecting them.
Yeah.
Magic wingtips.
Because presumably in a barrel roll, you have a fairly steady G-force on you downwards, right? Even at the top of the roll. I guess that's why, right? Yeah, you probably get a bit less sick than doing what they actually do in Star Fox, where they spin like crazy.
Can't see any problem with use the boost to get through, though.
No.
That's what I should have said as my opening line. There you go. My brain is caught up eventually.
It took a long time for podcast, but his brain finally caught up to the intro. Right.
Well, I hope that you use the boost to get through your illness, Rob.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for being here for Zach's three brand new games in a week.
Woo!
We started a new series recording anyway. Yes, a new
technically
series
four brand new games in a week, I guess.
Yeah, technically four.
I guess not brand new in that case. So, although Steam thinks so, by the way.
Oh, Steam thinks it's new.
And Steam's like, Zing played Half-Life 2 for the first time. It's like, nope.
Yes.
I guess yep. I played Half-Life 2 before that feature existed in Steam.
Before it was tracking, yeah.
Yeah.
So along with our new season of the Salacast with the new Star Fox theme tune, we are also starting a new video series coming soon to YouTube, the 20th anniversary of Half-Life 2. Which is a kick-ass game. So I look forward to that. Look out for that on YouTube. Happy Salad is the channel. And we'll be back here on happysalad.net and wherever you get your podcast with another Saladcast in 2 weeks' time. So we'll catch you then.
The hell of the pipes.
Bye.
Pipe dope.
Pipe dope.